The Madison Symphony has a concert this weekend, and it's an interesting combination of things, more so than usual, perhaps, with a Dvorak Slavonic dance represented, and then the work of a composer by the name of Joseph Jongin, or Jongin, depending upon how you want to approach him. That's a work for organ and orchestra, and then also the Mozart Requiem. And now the organist for the previously mentioned work, however you want to pronounce the composer's name, is Nathan Lauba, and he is right here with me, and welcome to the Midday.
Thanks so much.
You're all of what, like 25 or something like that?
25, that's right. A lot has happened pretty quickly.
Yeah. So how does a person get into becoming this kind of international organist at such an early age? Did you start with a piano? Was that a logical progression, or where did it come from?
Absolutely. I think it's a funny thing with organists. It's almost like a vocation in some ways. I think at some point you hear the instrument, and in whatever context that might be. For some people, that's in an organ recital that your piano professor took you to, or in church, of course, or sometimes in an unexpected situation. And you hear this instrument, and you're immediately captivated by the sound. And I think it's an instrument that people have a very strong reaction to upon their first hearing.
They do.
Yeah, it can go either way, as we know.
It can, because and it varies so much. It can vary so much.
That's right. And I think, for example, unfortunately, it's an organ that's often poorly represented simply because you have a lot of amateur organists playing in churches, and all you hear then is what we call the proverbial come to Jesus and whole notes, which is not really representing the organ well. Right. But as a concert instrument, this is really one of the most dynamic and fascinating instruments that we have.
It has been around in so many different contexts. I mean, in silent films, you would hear it.
Yeah, that's
and
right.
And then when the silence became talkies, you heard it on radio for dramas, melodramas, all kinds of things from the 30s into the early 60s even. And then I'm not sure I guess a bunch of those organists started playing game shows on TV and things like that.
Well, it's fascinating. I think that's one of the interesting things about the organ itself is just the vastness of what the instrument is. And what you refer to, of course, is the theater organ,
sure,
or the cinema organ. And then you also have, which is, it's like the cousin of the classical organ or the church organ. You have concert hall organs, you have cathedral organs, you have chamber organs. The scope of what the instrument is vast.
Yeah, not to mention the quaint old parlor organ.
Yeah, exactly. And the Hammond. I mean, the Hammond's its own instrument, too. I mean, extraordinary.
And the mighty Wurlitzer.
Exactly.
All of these things have their kind of emotional coloring for us, the listener, don't they?
That's right.
How did you get into it?
I heard the organ in church as a child, and I was always fascinated by architecture, particularly as a child. I was fascinated with Gothic and Romanesque ecclesiastical architecture, and that moved down into Frank Lloyd Wright, and so every facet of it, Bauhaus, everything. And I think there's always a great relationship between the organ and architecture. I think the organ is an architectural instrument in itself, just in the way the sound is created. And I think for me, what was fascinating was always that interplay between a room and those pipes.
Yeah, it's crucial, isn't it?
That's right. And the way that those pipes and the sound they make take on a new life in every room in which they're found. And this is something that all the great organ composers spoke about, that organ builders always speak about, and it's something that's really essential to the sound, the organ within its space.
So what is your space as an organist every day? I mean, what is your home base?
That's right. It's really interesting, actually, because it changes every week. I mean, it changes really every day. Of course, we're musicians who can't take our instrument with us. We have to go to the instrument.
Yes.
And for me, this is the great joy of the organ, is that there's never a boring day on the job, because every organ is entirely unique.
And complex.
And complex. And of course, even just in their scope, the instruments are incredibly different. One day you'll show up to play a concert and it'll be a two-manual organ in the style of organs that Bach would play. So an organ with two keyboards and with a mechanical action. So there's a direct linkage, like in a piano or in a harpsichord, between the key and the pipe. And there you're dealing with maybe an organ on a smaller scale, but that's perfect for a particular type of music and for music that was conceived for a particular purpose.
Sure, like the Handel organ concertos.
Exactly.
Lovely small scale works.
That's right. And we can really appreciate the chamber music quality of an organ. Then on another day, you'll go and you'll play an organ that's a massive organ with five keyboards, with 200 stops, you know, this expression, of course, pulling all the stops, pulling out all the stops. This is an organ expression.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, this, an organ like this, you know, which creates this huge, almost orchestral tapestry of sound, you know, that very much evokes the color and the character of the symphony orchestra.
And specific instruments.
That's right. So every day you're coming into contact with a different type of organ that endeavors to play a different type of literature and that serves a different function.
Now, about this piece that you're playing Friday night, 7:30, Saturday night, 8 o'clock, Sunday afternoon at 2:30. As long as you know, that's the main thing.
That's right. Yeah, it's helpful.
Overture Center, of course, this would be the organ there in Overture Center, which is, I gather, already one of the world-famous instruments.
Yeah, it's a very noteworthy organ, one of the first very important European exports, or rather imports, to the United States. We have an organ here by Kleiss Orgelbau of Bonn, Germany, and I had the pleasure of playing a solo recital here 2 years ago, and it was a thrill. It was really very, very enjoyable program for me to play, and I'm just thrilled to be back to play this particular work now by Joseph Jongen, Symphonie Concertante.
And what is the genesis of the Symphonie Concertante?
It's fascinating. This is it's so bizarre in a certain way, but it's just fun. It's just terrific. There is the world's largest organ in a department store here in the United States, if you can imagine. John Wanamaker, this merchandise tycoon, was a huge organ aficionado. There are actually a lot of different characters like this. I also teach at the Eastman School of Music, and the Eastman School of Music was founded by George Eastman, who was the founder of Kodak.
Of course.
Kodak, Eastman was a huge organ nut, and he installed in his house the largest residence organ in the world as well. And therefore, this was also the genesis of that particular program. And in the case of John Wanamaker, he purchased from the St. Louis Exposition this massive organ built by the Los Angeles Art Organ Company.
So this would have been 1903.
1903, exactly. He purchased this massive organ from this exposition and then brought it to his new department store that he had just built at Chestnut and Market Street in Philadelphia. It was really one of the first, iconic department stores of the world. And in this grand court, the central atrium, which is 7 floors tall and has cathedral-esque acoustics, he put up this organ. And he immediately deemed it wasn't big enough for the space, so he immediately opened within the store, in the attic, an actual organ-building workshop to augment the size of the instrument.
Well, it's nice to have options.
That's right. Well, I suppose when money's no option, yeah, too, these things, anything is possible. So this organ grew into what it is now, the largest organ in the world. With all of these different stops that endeavor to create the colors of the symphony orchestra itself. So when you sit down at this console, which has 6 keyboards, a pedal board, and then a absolute sea of stops on each side, these little tabs that are even color-coded so that, just to help you orient yourself to where things are located, you feel like you're in, 3 cockpits of an airplane combined, uh-huh. You see? It's quite a visual sight.
And was that common, for any kind of an organ to be in a department store 100 years ago?
Well, in fact, there was one in New York. There was another Wanamaker store, and he also had one put in. But organs at this time, we have to imagine, were also there was a great sense of this being really an entertaining instrument because it was so technologically complex, and to watch an organ play is quite visually stimulating. You see them, dancing up and down the pedal board. They're always manipulating these stops. They're dealing with 4 different keyboards. It's quite a visual feast
quite
in this
dance,
way.
Really, yeah.
That's right. So in his store in New York, he also had a very important organ, and this became the epicenter of organ culture in that city. All these great European organists would come over and play, and even in the Waldorf Astoria, there was a famous organ installed in their ballroom, et cetera, it goes on.
Those were the days. So is the one at Wanamaker's in Philadelphia?
It is. It is still
and
there.
And it's been kept up all these years.
That's right. In fact, it's in better shape than it's ever been in because they now have a full-time crew of restorers and curators who work on the organ every day and who have been gradually restoring it to its original spectacular beauty. And what's fantastic about this is one of the few places in the United States where every day you can hear 2 organ recitals in that room. There is an organ recital at noon and an organ recital at 5:30, in addition to major recitals they'll do collaborating, for example, with the Philadelphia Orchestra. So what's amazing about this particular work, the Jongen Symphony Concertante that I'll be playing, is this particular piece was commissioned by Rodman Wanamaker, the son of John Wanamaker, who is even more of an organ nut than John. And Rodman had heard about the music of Jongen and said, you know, here we have this organ that in itself is a symphony orchestra. What could be greater than bringing in, at that time, certainly the greatest symphony orchestra in the United States, the Philadelphia Orchestra under the direction of Leopold Stokowski, bringing that into the same space and having these two orchestras pitted against each other, or rather in dialogue and in conversation with each other.
We hope, yes.
Yeah. So this is what was intended to have happened. The piece was commissioned in 1926, and sadly, first of all, there were issues just getting the work completed and the organ completed. And then secondly, Rodman Wanamaker died. So the first time the piece was actually performed in that space for which it had been conceived was in 2008 with the Wanamaker Grand Court organist today, Peter Richard Conti, and the Philadelphia Orchestra. And I was at that concert as well, at the time when I was an assistant organist at Wanamaker, so I knew the instrument well, and it was a really magical event.
So not to put in a plug, but you can actually go shopping at Wanamaker's in Philadelphia and hear this organ concert in
the
background.
That's right. That's right.
Can't be too many places in the world you can do that.
That's right. Well, and it's particularly amusing, too, because where the organ console itself, the actual, you know, playing console is located is in the middle of, you know, women's lingerie. So, you know, it's always kind of a strange thing as this little organist, you know, walking through that, going to the organ console.
You might say slipping in.
That's right. Exactly.
Well, let's hear some of the Jongen then that is the product of this fascinating combination of historical forces. We'll hear some of the first movement anyway, and what's the premise here, Nathan?
This first movement, here we really see perhaps Jongen being a great amalgamator of style. Jongen was a composer who definitely came right out of the great 19th century French tradition of Dandy and of Franck and of all these great people, Saint-Saëns, and yet also won the Grand Prix de Rome and studied with composers like Richard Strauss, the father of the tone poem in some ways, you know, or rather the great exponent of the tone poem after Liszt. And we see in this movement all these different influences coming together. He begins with a fugue, a very unusual thing to do in 1930, you know.
Yes.
And then, of course, the organ comes in and we immediately realize we're back in the cathedral with these huge arcades of sound. But then we really see this beautiful, evocative romantic writing, very lyrical, very, very majestic, and indeed very Belgian.
From 1926, and this is the Philadelphia Orchestra. Is that 2008 performance?
That's right.
So the first time this was actually performed in the intended space there at Wanamaker's department store in Philadelphia.
That's right.
I can see what you mean about the influences of Richard Strauss on the one hand, you know, kind of the Germanic school, and the Franco-Belgian sound, too. So when you get into that B theme, it's, in case you forgot, this is a Belgian composer.
That's right, exactly. It's very sensual harmonies, very evocative music.
Is there a particular part of this piece that's a challenge for you?
I think... Well, I suppose, you know, the final movement is just a bit of an exercise in endurance. You know, this is the famous toccata in this particular movement. You have, I don't know, a good 30 pages of 16th notes just from start to finish.
And you just sort of 30 pages.
You start and then you finish. You know, it's one of those things. And this particular movement was made extremely popular and famous by a great American organ virtuoso, or the flamboyant character by the name of Virgil Fox.
Oh, yes, who did light shows sometimes.
Exactly. And then who came to Madison a number of times, as I understand.
Yes, unfortunately not recently, of course.
That's right. Yeah, exactly. Sadly, I never had
with us for some time.
The chance to meet him, but it's definitely a character I would have loved to have known. But Virgil would play this piece by himself on the organ. And this is the final movement, the toccata, which is entitled Moto Perpetuo. So this is the...
It never stops.
Exactly.
And at least for the organist, it probably seems not to.
That's right. It's a scream to play. It's just a real joy. And what you have here is a lot of traditions coming together. Notably here, Jean-Guin really appropriates this famous tradition of 19th century French organ toccatas. We think of those of Vidor and of Vierne and all of these guys. And you always have this flurry of notes in the manuals, this rapid succession of 16th notes in one oscillating figure or another. And then under that usually comes the great pedal theme, or in this case, it's in the left hand, a really brassy theme, but very sort of quintessential Jean-Guinian theme. And a really dramatic final statement. And what's particularly wonderful about this is Jean-Guin, his sense of color is so magnificent. And in the previous three movements, the moderato, the divertimento, which is full of rhythmic energy and wonderful, capricious interplay between the organ and orchestra, and then this wonderfully misterioso third movement, the lento, all of those moments, even if they have climaxes, they all end very poetically and very quietly on the softest stops of the organ. So finally, in this fourth movement, he finally lets you pull out all the stops and just really lets you have it.
Now, let me ask you this, Nathan, before we get into some of this toccata. When you play a work written for the organ, which in your case would be virtually all the time, is every little thing prescribed by the composer, every little stop, every little nuance of shading?
It really depends on the period. It depends on the period in which the piece was written. Just like any scores in general, you know, when you go back to the music, let's say, of even relatively late music, if you think about the grand arch of music, when you go back to Bach, the amount of indications that he's given you in the score are very minimal. Occasionally, he'll give you a little articulation marking. Occasionally, he'll give you a dynamic marking, you know, piano or forte, but nothing beyond that. Occasionally, he'll give you a little indication of registration. Sometimes he'll say, okay, change manuals here, change the keyboard, something like that. 100 years later, already we have twice that much with composers like Mendelssohn, yeah, and with composers like Liszt. 100 years later with Franck, with Jean-Guin, with Durufle, it becomes really quite prescriptive. And then later with composers like Messiaen, he writes every detail into the score. So as is the case with all music, the closer we come to our present time, the more prescriptive composers have become. You look at the scores of the symphonies of Mahler, and every note has an indication over it, yeah? But for example, in the score of Jean-Guin, it's interesting, I think organ composers, and particularly composers who are organ performers themselves, like Jean-Guin, were keenly aware of the fact that every organ is different. So they will give you general guidelines within a certain organ tradition. So they know, okay, if you need tutti, they'll write tutti, and they can say, you could give you a certain indication of maybe, you know, use trumpets, use the big 32-foot stops in the pedal for gravity, and they'll give you some indications like that. But they then trust the organist that he will find, or she will find, the sound that that fits the spirit of the music at that moment. At other times, though, for solos, he'll say, now I want an oboe solo. Now I want strings. Now I want the 32. I want this stop that's yet an octave lower than the contrabass and the orchestra, you know, for that special gravity that only the organ can provide. So yes and no, he does give you some general guidelines for volume and for color, and then he gives you some very specific colors that emulate the colors from the orchestra.
Best organ music, you think, written by organists?
Well, in some ways, I think, you know, all of Bach, of course, was a great organ music, and you can't argue, organist, you know, you can't argue with that. Mendelssohn was a great organist, and his organ music is spectacular. And then you have this great tradition of 19th and 20th century French and German composers, Max Reger, Vidor, Vierne, Franck, of course. These were all people who wrote music for the symphony. You know, in his day, Vidor, who's now primarily recognized as an organ composer, he was the chair of the composition department at the Paris Conservatoire. You know, this was someone that all the great musicians of their time would have known and come in contact with. So even though nowadays they're often remembered primarily for their organ compositions, because in some ways someone like Vidor was overshadowed by people like, I don't know, Debussy. You know, I mean, these towering figures. You see. But nonetheless, these were very important and influential musicians of their time. But indeed, those composers who understood the organ and understood the spirit of the instrument and the nature of the instrument, of course, left us our greatest music.
Well, here's some of that final movement, the best known of the movements of the Symphonie Concertante of Joseph Gingin, the Toccata. Oh, you know, we haven't mentioned that this particular performance features as the organist.
We have Peter Richard Conti, my mentor when I was at Wanamaker's.
And
then the Philadelphia Orchestra with Rosin Milinov.
Yeah, so this is a little bit of that last movement of the Toccata, and it's also a moto perpetuo, you said.
That's right.
So a show of skill plus never-ending.
That's right.
The challenge at the end of this symphony concertante. Romantic, and as toccatas go, has this kind of big, lush luxuriance about it.
That's right, absolutely. And I was thinking, you know, you hear especially in this influence of these great French composers of the time writing this very evocative and programmatic music, composers like Paul Dukas, the Sorcerer's Apprentice, and things like this. It's the same harmonic language, very, very illustrative of these different, beautiful ideas.
Very evocative, too. I'm sure we'll all of us in the audience have these images that you conjure. But of course, that's when you're not being closely watched doing your dance with all
that's
those
right.
keys and pedals and stops. Quite the production itself. Nathan Lauba, thanks for stopping by.
It's been a pleasure. Thanks so much.
It's been a very interesting insights you've been providing into that instrument, the king of instruments, as they call it, and some of the things written for it. And gosh, makes me want to go to Wanamaker's and buy something.
Yeah, that's right. Worth a visit. Worth a visit.
The concerts, again, are this weekend, 7:30 tomorrow night, Madison Symphony, 8 o'clock Saturday night, and then 2:30 Sunday afternoon, Overture Center for the Arts in Madison. You get to hear the Overture concert organ as played by Nathan Lauba. You get to hear all of that symphony concertante. Also on the program, a Slavonic dance by Dvorak and the Mozart Requiem.